Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. So we are here today talking about the Center for Contemporary Arts, the CCA Cinematheque, and the CCA, as probably many of our listeners know, was in trouble and was almost going to close at the end of last year on the 31st of December, but has managed not to do so. And so in celebration of one of the most important parts of the CCA, the Cinematheque, we have here Jason Silverman, who is the director of the CCA Cinematheque, and Bob Gaylor, who is founder and former director of the CCA and has done also a great deal of the film programming, and Brent Cleaver, the director of the Screen, which is on the campus of the College of Santa Fe, and he was for many years director of the Cinematheque. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi. Glad to be here.
Glad to be here.
So, Bob Gaylor, let's start with you. That you founded the CCA in the 1980s, is that correct?
Actually, it was started in 1979, and it changed its name a long way. Just as a little preamble to that, in the early 70s, like 71, 72, 73, I began making films myself. I made probably 20 films as a visual artist, not as a narrative filmmaker, and founded in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Pittsburgh Filmmakers, which still goes strong today. It has a large movie theater similar to the Lenzik, and it's the film school for two or three universities and so on. I was the founder and one of the founders and the president of the board of that organization before I came to Santa Fe in 78. And I got a call when I got here, shortly after I got here, from a guy named Elton Walpole. He said, "Hey, Bob, I heard you came here from Pittsburgh, and we got this building down on Old Pecos Trail from the state, and we have a little video collective, and wonder if you could help us get started with that." And so as a result of that, they call themselves Rising Sun. So, and I came here to visit a friend of mine, Linda Klosky, who was co-founder of the CCA. And Linda was formerly a curator at the Minneapolis College of Art and Design, and also a very good artist and filmmaker herself. That's how we met. And so we got involved and started a little thing called the Rising Sun Media Arts Center. And we created a little screening room down in the basement of the Armory, 50 seats with folding chairs and 16-millimeter projector, and started showing films. And we had dark rooms, and we had a range of other activities, a little gallery in the hallway. And so from there, we sort of segued into CCA, which we incorporated that in 83, and we remodeled that building pretty much as it is right now. And finished up and moved in there April of 85.
What was the larger than and including the Cinematheque, what was the sort of goal and mission of the CCA at that time?
Well, the mission was to create an art center that was cross-disciplinary, that we believed that one kind of art form nourishes another kind of art form, and that the richest kind of art experience is to be able to, for the public and for artists as well, in my view, is to be able to understand and work within and participate in and see and hear a range of art forms. So we always had that as our mission, really. So we had poetry readings, and we had cinema, we had dance performances, we had performance art, we had visual arts exhibitions and so forth. So all of these things were on the program constantly every month, and that was how we ran it then. And
Now, in terms of the Cinematheque, what was the purpose of the... Well, how did you program the movies that you were showing in the beginning?
Well, in the very beginning, that we were limited to 16 millimeter, so we showed a lot of the films that were made in 35 that had been converted to 16. A lot of the European films, for example, also film artists that were working in 16 millimeter, and we also brought in filmmakers and had them talk. Like, for example, we brought in the earliest 80s, Joe Dorowski, and we showed El Topo, and he talked, and you know, so we did a range of things like that. Once we moved to the bigger space, we were able to acquire a 35 millimeter projection system, by the way, which Mr. Cleaver helped us to acquire. Remember, Brent?
Yeah, right.
And we built that little theater there, and it's still basically the same theater. We got some new seats along the way, but
new gum under the seats.
New gum under the seats, yeah.
New gum under the seats, right.
So, Brent, when did you start programming the Cinematheque at the CCA?
1986, and it 1986 to 1996, and they were the best years of my life, really, I have to admit. And so much credit goes to Bob and Linda, because Bob had a vision, and he allowed people to do their thing, and that's so important in any organization, and gave people the freedom to do their thing. And it's pretty simple, kind of the creative gelling that came in being around the CCA in those early years, or when I was there in the mid-80s on. There was such a creative spirit there, and people bounced off each other. And even when you had personality issues sometimes, it always kind of manifest itself in something creative. And it's like nothing else I've been part of.
Brent Cleaver, tell us a little bit about your own history in film. I remember the first time I ever visited Santa Fe was 1989, and I remember going to the CCA, and before whatever film we were watching, you gave an impassioned mini lecture on Keith Slavsky's Decalogue. And I looked at you and I thought, this man is possessed by some kind of cinematic demon or something like that. I was really impressed, and continued going to the CCA forever after. And not hard to miss the incredible passion that you brought to it. Tell us a little about your own background.
Well, I grew up in a small town where I'm speaking to you from at the moment as well, in Oklahoma. And I'd like to say I have all these degrees in film history and whatnot, but the fact is I don't. Mine is self-taught out of love for the medium since I was probably 3 or 4 years old. I mean, literally, I went from a town here with one theater, you know, 2,500 people, and I literally, the films would change 4 or 5 times a week back in the 60s and whatnot. It's a much different conception of theater exhibition, although the one theater still here in town, but it shows things a week or 2 weeks at one film for 2 weeks or a week at a time, whatever. So it became kind of an obsession with me, and just I couldn't get enough films. And believe me, it came from sitting in dark spaces watching movies. And I couldn't tell you how many a week.
Right.
And I ran a film society in Tulsa, at Tulsa University. And my entry into Santa Fe was the old Collective Fantasy Theater down in Montezuma, which I turned into the Jean Cocteau.
So I'd
like to say there's a secret, but when you love something, I found out in life, when you love something, you pursue it on your own. You read everything you can about it. You watch everything you can. And that's where you really learn anyway.
What was your... I don't know if you want to call it programming philosophy, but how did you program during your years at the CCA? How did you make the choices among all the many things out there?
Well, it's first of all, you kind of know your audience. I mean, Santa Fe, it's a very intimate relationship with the audience, and it's never, you never get to a point where you're condescending to an audience. You always challenge the audience to a degree, and the audience begins to trust you as well. And so you can play the esoterica, and once you build that bond, that relationship, it's amazing how what people come to that, you know, Santa Fe is a little bitty town compared to your major metropolitan areas, isn't always been known as one of the great places for specialized cinema, independent cinema, foreign language cinema, whatever you call it, art house cinema. And it's something that goes with intuition. And when you get kind of people on a roll, you throw some curves in there, because as a mission, and as Bob will tell you, a mission of CCA and whatnot, was to also bring things and showcase things that people would never have a chance to see. And as I said, when you I've been programming in Santa Fe for 20-some years, and it begins to be intuitive. Now, that said, the audience is changing over the years here, and the whole industry is changing. The whole mode of filmmaking itself, with the dawn of digital and whatnot, is changing. And I think Jason will probably agree with me that this transformation and also kind of the dying of the cinema culture, so to speak, the older audience, is posing new problems in how we sustain ourselves in programming art houses. We're kind of a dying breed. But back then it was exciting because everybody was into it. And you could do, like we had that great premiere, as you said, of the Kieslowski movie Decalogue. And I don't have time to tell you how hard it was to get that because of the nutty lady in Canada that owned the rights to this and refused to let people see it. And sometimes you don't realize how, you know, in this business, you know, her husband actually had bought the rights and died, and she ended up with them. North American rights, this wasn't the same problem in Europe, but she was a nut. And she wanted like $50,000 just to play one theater. I mean, something totally ridiculous. And I could go on and on about this story, but it was also, you dealt with these kind of people sometimes. You'd be amazed how individual films would end up with these kind of crazy people. It wasn't just, you know, the normal channels of distribution that you sometimes, you know, assume.
Right. Jason Silverman, so you are carrying on in this great tradition of Bob Gaylor and Brent Cleaver. How has your job changed because of these things, the changes in the way films are made, audiences, the film industry, and so on? How has that changed what you do?
Well, I got to stop for back up for 1 second and say I was at that Decalogue screening too. I don't know if it was 89, whenever it was.
I don't know if it was 89. Whenever. I remember the impassioned lecture. It wasn't about Decalogue. He was talking about Decalogue at the beginning of a different film. But anyway,
yeah.
Yes.
I've spent a lot of time in theaters, and that's one of the top three or four highlights of
that's
my
life. It's one of the greatest
a,
film series. It was wasn't it made, Brent, for Polish television?
Yeah, made for Polish television.
I saw there's, you know, there's the 10 hour-long mini features, and then there's the two
expanded features.
And I saw all 12 of them in a week.
Right. We brought the two extended features as well. And
then I went and bought the script and read that, and then I bought the Kieslowski biography and read that, and I mean, that screening changed my life, and you know, that's one reason that I've been so loyal to CCA, is all the work that Brent did. Before we talk about me, though, I also want to mention Jerry Barron, who carried the flame for another 7 years between me and Brent.
And couldn't be with us today on this
couldn't
show.
Couldn't be with us today, but he, you know, last night and this morning, we're preparing to do a fundraiser at the CCA to celebrate the Cinematheque. We have this binder that a volunteer created for us with all of the old Cinematheque programs from 1984 to the present, and I spent 5 or 6 hours leafing through them. And it's just amazing what Bob and Brent and Jerry did. I don't think there's a theater in the world that now does the kind of work that the Cinematheque did in the 80s and 90s, bringing in films from, you know, every corner, you know.
And directors and actors.
Directors, right. I mean, it, you know, it, I remember we had that tribute to Uriah Jakubiska. We were packed. I mean, nobody knows this guy, the Slovakian director. You know, Woody Vasulka knew him, but went to school with him. But nobody knew him, and it's just like we play these obscure things, and it would just be packed. And let me give credit, too. You mentioned those wonderful, wonderful CCA programs and all the work Linda Klosky put into those. And, yeah. And of course, Linda's ethnographic series, which, you know, was such a mainstay of CCA, the Ethnographic Film Festival. That was her project that was so successful there.
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, it's like walking through the aisles at Video Library. I mean, just crazy stuff from all around the world. You know, it would be better, you know, to have attended CCA during those days, and I think to go to film school. You would have learned more watching movies there.
Well, I think an important point to just note while we're having this conversation is the fact that when you have access to that kind of a film culture and you use that by going to it, it actually changes the culture in which you live. It changes your life, your heart, the way you see, because of this kind of access. And I think there's no underestimating the damage that is done when people are only fed a much narrower cinematic fare.
Well, you asked the question. Oh, go ahead, Grant.
Yeah, that's the problem that faces us today is back then, obviously, there wasn't anything called the Internet. And what people gravitate toward today is something I haven't really figured out, and I don't know if there is a figuring out, to be honest with you. And the younger audience, getting the younger audience to go and explore the type of cinema we're talking about is a very difficult endeavor. And and Jason will tell you the same, that we're tied to this loyal support of this older audience in Santa Fe over the past, 30 years or so, that is, quite frankly, dying off. And there's not the younger audience isn't there to replace it at this time. So we're kind of in an interesting period now, transitional period.
I think cinephilia is alive and well. People are watching things differently than they used to. So, I showed Monica this, one of my favorite Bergman films, an early Bergman film. And I think, Brent, had you shown that in the early 90s, we would have had great houses for it, but it was empty for me.
Right.
And I was just thinking, for the price of that ticket and for the time it takes to head over to the theater, you could just hop on the computer, Netflix half a dozen early Bergman films, and have your own Bergman festival at home.
But it's a different experience. I mean, you just can't, the dark theater, Bob. You know what that dark theater means. I mean that communal, experience.
Well, I'm just having that level of sound and that kind of
sound
degree
and
of picture and so forth is hard to duplicate in most.
And size matters here, guys. The metaphors that don't, a metaphor that's small on the TV screen, and even I know we're getting into bigger and bigger HD type things, but forever I always remember Angela Carter, wonderful magical realist writer and essayist, was trying to describe back in the 70s what the difference was between movies on TV, as opposed to TV movies, mind you, and movies in the theater. And she used Double Indemnity as an example of Barbara Stanwyck's ankle bracelet. And it's this little fetishistic touch that Billy Wilder uses when she comes down the stairs. And there, in a movie theater where it's like 10 times the size of life, so to speak, you see this huge image of her feet come down the stairs of this ankle bracelet, and it cuts to Fred McMurray, and you understand the erotic potential in that scene visually. But when you watch it, say, on video, on television, it's all lost.
You know, my concern, because you're a much bigger film buff than I am, I love movies, My concern is less about the loss of film culture as it is the loss of gathering places. I mean, the
I think that's what I, when I was mentioning the dark space in the communal sense, that part of it is a shared experience.
We need that. We need that these days. I mean, people go, you know, most of our gathering spaces, most of our communal moments happen in malls, you know, and or watching a football game at home with, you know, four or five people. And the idea of getting people together in a theater and watching a film that spurs dialogue and creates a sense of connection among neighbors or people who haven't met, that's a really powerful opportunity that I don't think we want to lose in this community.
Yeah, I think that's a good component of a really performing of any kind of an art center that's doing its job, I feel. And that's essentially why we started the Warehouse 21 back in 88, because it was such for grown-ups, but it was even worse for kids who were driving around in cars or meeting at the mall, you know. So
right. Well, I was thinking the other day, you can at this point have anything sent to your house. You can have you can buy a coat and have it sent to your house, or a pair of shoes, your mail, your movies, your books, everything. So all of these things, like going to the theater and going to the library and so on, don't happen nearly as much as they used to. And so all the chance encounters with strangers don't happen, and then everybody's on Match.com trying to meet strangers and paying for it.
Right. Yeah, and there's we have a drive-through culture, and you can pull out of your space at work and you drive right into your garage at home, and you walk right into your living room, and you don't encounter another human being.
Yeah, and you just flip on Google and eBay, and your life is complete.
Right, and then email has its own dialect, so to speak,
or lack thereof.
Lack thereof, and nobody, you know, if people don't converse, it's there's an oddly antisocial element that's been created by all this technology, and I think that, you know, you could see it coming. I don't think that's too hard to.
Well, maybe it's a reaction to the overpopulation.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, the fact is that there are great advantages to some parts of it as well, and the fact is it's not going anywhere. And so the question is, and turning again to you, Jason Silverman, how do you then program at the CCA in the reality that we're living in?
Well, one of the things that was important to me when I took the job was that the space be accessible to community groups, because there's a lot of important work being done in Santa Fe, and everyone wants to watch a movie and talk about it. So someone like Veterans for Peace or the American Institute of Architects, I mean, there's about 70 groups that we've invited into the Cinematheque to present programming in the five and a half years I've been there. And, you know, I threw out a term the other day to one of our board members. I said, Cinematheque is Santa Fe's living room. I like to think about it as a way that we can, that different kinds of people can get together and connect, that they can break out of the sense of alienation or loneliness that they may feel because of these cultural pressures, and come out and see something that's meaningful to them, have a good conversation, maybe deepen their understanding of the world a little bit, at least make some meaningful human connection. If we can do that at the theater, that's great. And then I just try to carry the torch forward in terms of, you know, the celebrating all the great films that Bob and Linda and Brent and Jerry started, because it's a big mantle to carry. There's a lot of amazing films.
Well, most great films never get distributed.
Right.
You know, the ones that get distributed are the ones that can make money. That's the only risk that you can take.
We used to bring so many stuff in by Europe, and God knows how what we paid in shipping fees sometimes, but you'd go directly to the source, and that's almost impossible to do anymore. You have to connect on to, you know, a touring program or something that select places are doing anymore. But we used to, you know, I remember in the days and we just go directly after the film and have to deal with French sales agents a lot of times, because they would control the rights so on, even though it wasn't in distribution, and the whole way that they have a scam going out at how you get prints from France and whatnot. But a lot of the French control rights to films in different parts of the world because they're just big sales agents there. But then you'd go directly sometimes to the director, you know, especially the old Soviet Union, where there are no rights, you know, where right after the fall of the Soviet Union, the state owned these films. So in places like Georgia and places like Ukraine and places like Armenia and then, say, the steppe countries like Kazakhstan and Central Asia and all that, these films didn't revert to anybody. There was nothing there. There was no state. And so I worked with some people in helping preserve some of these things because there would be like one or two prints in existence of some great work from these parts of the world that were going to be lost forever. But just the communicating and the bureaucracy and whatnot, and once the state collapsed. So it's very interesting. So a filmmaker could say, you know, you could play his film, but he didn't have any idea where it was, what the rights were, or right. The fact it was no rights. It's somewhat similar to when Nazi Germany fell. And, UFA, who had controlled, you know, so many of the big studio there, who controlled all the German silent films, or made a lot of them, finally the Germans had the right way of doing it, informing a holding company that now owns all those films under the name F.W. Murnau Stiftung. And so all those films made it up, UFA, all the Fritz Lang films, all the Murnau films, all the German silent films and German films in general up through a certain point are owned by a holding company. It's some of the bigger studios like Moss Film and Lin Film did, but anyway. But it can get very complicated is what I'm
A lot of times we got films directly, as you say, from directors.
Right.
And they would come with them. They'd bring them.
Right. We're talking to Bob Gaylor, who is founder and former director of the CCA, Brent Cleaver, director of The Screen, former director of the Cinematheque at the CCA, and Jason Silverman, current director of the CCA Cinematheque. So I wanted to ask each one of you in turn, starting with Bob Gaylor, what are the favorite, if you have a favorite movie that you ever brought to the CCA, or maybe a top two or three?
Oh, I'd have to say, you know, top 100, but when Brent mentioned the ethnographic series that Linda Klosky was doing, it just came to mind as he said that, one of the films that I remember so distinctly and was so powerful, and also we had a hard time getting, Brent, if you may recall, was maybe a three-hour-long documentary from the Canadian Film Board, which was called The Shimmering Beast.
Right.
And it was a documentary about two guys who go hunting. And one guy was a hunter, and the other guy was an office worker who had never gone hunting. And it was like the most wonderful, revealing film about the insecurities of manhood that I've ever seen in my life. It was fabulous.
No, I totally agree.
Brent, how about you? Favorite movie or couple of movies?
Oh, God. We're talking 10 years. The aforementioned Uri Yoskubisko series we did, The Millennial Bee, is an unknown masterpiece. It was made in Slovakia in the 1980s. Just a terrific film that unfortunately people don't have a chance to see. Vera Chitilova made a film called The Gesture and the Queen as well. That, again, of all of Vera, she's the Czech director of all of Vera's films, it's one film that's not mentioned too much in her filmography that I think is actually one of her great films. And, then we do have things like The Decalogue. We do have, there's just so much. I remember all the early Jan Schwenkmeyer things when they first became available on film, the shorts, the magnificent shorts of Jan Schwenkmeyer.
Yeah.
I mean, wow.
What about you, Jason Silverman?
Well, we did we were the film component of a citywide project called The Disappeared. And
yes.
Which was, we had a great program, and we brought in filmmakers from all around, and we brought...
That was an exhibition at Site Santa Fe and a number of other sites throughout the community,
yes.
And it was one of the most powerful visual art exhibitions I've ever seen in my whole entire life, which is a lot of freaking art exhibitions.
It was an amazing show, and it was really an honor to be asked to curate the film portion, which we did with an international team, and but we brought a film called Magic Gloves, which I had heard of and not yet seen before I'd looked into it, and we brought the filmmaker out, and there was probably 12 people in the audience. We showed in Albuquerque, there was maybe 8 people in the audience. It's just this delightful film. He was a delightful guy. So that's the Cinephiliac one, but one that I don't entirely love the film, but it was a really important moment. The CCA was on the verge my first year, and I managed to see a film in an empty screening room at Sundance called Something Emperor. I can't remember what the original name was. And a friend of mine bought it for Warner Brothers, and they decided to change the voiceover and give it a new title, and it became March of the Penguins.
Oh, my goodness.
And we booked that, and that's the film that rescued the CCA. We made enough money on that we could keep the light bills paid and pay the rent and keep the place open for another few months, which basically allowed us to turn it around. So I'm really fond of that film for that reason.
Well, you also had Winged Migration, which I think made a lot of money. That was one was a penguin film. The other was a bird film.
Bird films. Brent will tell you.
But Birds and Dance.
Birds and Dance.
And Dance and Birds, whichever way you want to use it. Interesting, too, Jason mentioned, just to show you the it's very different, too. There was a Japanese film years ago about a cat and a dog called Adventures of Milo and Otis. And the American release had this, like, Dudley Moore narration in near typical kind of Disney-esque. They got rid of the Ryuko Sakamoto music and put some bland, goofy score on there. And it was like two different pictures. And I think I've never seen the original March of the Penguins that was, you know, less. And I understand they cut a couple of violent scenes and whatnot. But I hear it's a much different picture as well. So, you know, things like that do happen. And correct me if I'm wrong, Jason. Was it not? Did you see the...
I loved the French version. I thought the American version was okay. And I was about to send my friend who bought the film an angry letter saying, how dare you do that? And then all of a sudden I saw the grosses.
Yeah, well, no, this goes with territory. But it's amazing sometimes when you see these adapted for different cultures what different films are. Like Milo and Otis is this marvelous, marvelous, one of the great Japanese films. But when you see Dudley Moore doing his, you know, Dudley Moore act as a narrator and speaking for both the cat and the dog, and then the sappy score that was this wonderful Sakamoto score originally. You sometimes realize the demands of commercialism on this culture, and to an extent, condescension. Now, maybe they were right in that. It wouldn't have done the business, obviously, if it was French and speaking, and they're trying to get a family audience on the Penguin film or either one of these films. But it's a shame that people didn't get a chance to see the other versions.
Brent, you know, I was thinking about the incredible stuff that the Japanese animators do, and I remember the one that I thought was brilliant was My Friend Totoro.
Totoro, My Neighbor Totoro, right.
My Neighbor, yeah.
Yes.
Totoro, what amazing.
Now, the Miyazaki film. I was a big anime fan and always liked to play anime, still do. And,
The CCA the CCA introduced me to Miyazaki and introduced me to Jackie Chan and introduced me to Kozlowski.
Right.
I mean, some of the things that are now the most important to me in terms of cinema, I learned at the CCA.
And I have to say, I learned at the CCA I saw at the CCA movies from countries that I didn't even know made films. There was a film from Mali called Yelene, which means brightness, which I've never forgotten, which was a fantastic film. And there was a film whose name I can't remember, which was a mythological type of story from Lapland.
The Pathfinder.
Yeah,
Pathfinder.
That was a brilliant film. Yeah.
Brilliant. You brought that back.
That was another highlight, real highlight. That now that you mentioned that. Yeah, the African. Interestingly, too, the African films and just because I know Jason does an African effect series, when in the early days, African films were like surefire hits. I mean, you could get the most obscure African film. And another hit we had was a film called Yaba, also from Burkina Faso. That were just enormous audiences. And, I mean, these were esoteric films. Films that didn't do any business anywhere else and probably only had one or two prints that were circulating around. But in Santa Fe, it would just be
right.
have just a incredible following. You can't do that today. You really can't. At least my experience is.
There were also a number of films, and I can't remember when they were. I'm sure all three of you know immediately, but there was a 8-hour documentary about Mongolia, and then narrative film about Mongolia.
Ricky Ottinger film.
And so there was a lot of yurts, and I ended up wondering, and the films were full, and I ended up wondering afterwards whether the proliferation of yurts in northern New Mexico was due to the CCA.
That's an Ulrike Ottinger film, which was 8 hours. I mean,
I went to both nights.
I can't think of the title off the top of my head.
You don't get those. You don't get that kind of audience loyal. I mean, and you're right, that those days... I don't know if they're quite behind us, but the
Tiger.
Audience,
Tiger was the name of it.
The audiences are not.
Yeah.
The audiences are not as adventurous here, I think, as they used to be.
I agree.
Or there's more to choose from, or they're being adventurous in other medias, and you know they're watching it on DVD or they're seeing it on cable, or I don't know what it is, but
also
it is harder.
I think they're much more sensitive these days, to be honest with you, and whether it's to the economic reasons, the messes we're in, or whatever, their own personal life. You know, anything that is hints of being a downer, pardon the you know,
right,
would be bluntly, is tough to, I mean,
to
you
say.
Know, it's kind of like you want, everybody kind of wants that happy drug thing.
You know, another thing I'd say is that Hollywood is more dominant now in the marketplace than it has ever been. And the marketing budgets are through the roof, and the control of the theater, the exhibition spaces is more complete. The theater systems themselves are you know, close to a monopoly system. So the business considerations are not helpful for independent art house theaters either. I mean, you know, Santa Fe has a lot of great movies playing at any given moment. I mean, De Vargas is a Regal theater, but it plays specialty titles, the kind of specialty titles that used to wind up at places like the Screen or the CCA.
Right. Yeah, too bad you can't see the whole picture on the screen, and there's wires hanging down into it.
Yeah, and don't buy. Yeah, the subtitles are.
Did we talk about masking?
Well, that's another thing.
As long as we're throwing things out.
That's another thing too that Brent and Bob and Jerry really focus their energy on that I think is really important is professional exhibit. I mean, you know, these filmmakers put a lot of love into making these pictures. A lot of times they made them out of passion, not expecting any money in return, and they slaved over them, and the films deserve the love of the exhibitors to be shown properly, to be shown with proper masking, to be shown with good sound, and
the correct aspect ratio.
The correct aspect ratio with clean plates. I mean, it's like, and you just don't get that in the commercial,
No dirt on the film.
Right. Yeah.
You get films that's only print circulating, and it may be a little beat up, but you unfortunately go to these multiplexes, and after the opening weekend, forget it. There's a big green emulsion scratch running down, you know,
the middle of George Clooney's forehead.
Right, exactly.
I actually think that some of the stuff that's going on with the digital exhibition is something that needs to be explored in the art house venue.
It will. When the economies of scale make it happen, it'll happen. Everyone's interested in it.
Well, but the scale is small, so you can do lots of different things in one space, maybe.
So far, the money doesn't quite work out.
It doesn't, but it's a...
Yeah, it's one of these things. There has to be a standardization. And you remember when sound first came in 1927, you know, you had... Vitaphone disc at that time. Then you had sound on film, which Fox Film Corporation introduced in this country, called Movietone, optical sound on film. It forced something that a lot of people don't realize. Besides giving you sound, it also forced the aspect ratio into being standardized, because you had, you know, in order for all theaters to be able to play all films, you had to have a standardization of the picture. And in the silent days, you had ratios all over the place. I mean, there was no standardization. When sound came in, it forced standardization of the aspect ratio, and that's why it's called the Academy ratio, the 1:3:7 aspect ratio. And then, of course, when you had widescreen come in later on in to combat television in the 50s, it was the same thing. I mean, you had to find, you know, do it to where all theaters could adapt to it so that they could play a product. We're somewhat in the same territory with digital right now, in the fact that nothing's standardized. I mean, you just saw, you know, Blu-ray went out over, it's the old VHS versus Beta debate, or the Blu-ray versus whatever that Toshiba competitor was. You know, it all starts having to shake itself out. And right now, it's still an inventor's medium, which they're never satisfied, and they keep going, and that's why the costs on these things are just enormous. Until it gets standardized, you're not going to see that drop in the price.
When it comes, though, it's going to come, and if independent exhibitors are savvy, it can really help save them, because you're going to be able to start programming your theater like you program your TiVo, basically. You know, there's going to be a whole world of content out there. And if you can build audiences for niche content, that's going to be the question. If you can build audiences for niche content, you're going to have access to it cheap.
Well, every independent can get a DVD of their movie. Every independent cannot get a 35-millimeter print archive of their,
right,
of their work. So yeah, it's a whole different ballgame.
Now, this is something that I probably shouldn't be asking to three independent cinema programmers, but while all of these things that you have all said about Hollywood and the current film industry are true in terms of cinema, because of Netflix and because of video stores like the Video Library and so on, there is perhaps more than ever access to the classics. Do you think people are watching those classics as much as or more than they used to?
If they're in the catalog, they're watching them.
Oh, yeah. No, people know more. You know, I think cinephilia is alive and well. People are really into movies. They watch more now than ever before. They just watch them in different ways. And they still come to the theater. I mean, you know, we've been, as the independent art house numbers slump kind of year to year, I think Santa Fe has remained pretty steady. I mean, the places that have a film culture are going to survive. We do have a lot of screens here in Santa Fe for a small population.
It depends on the program, too, sometimes with the older stuff. Over at the screen, we just opened this celebrating Chekhov series, 150th birthday of Chekhov, and I was pretty much blown away by the turnout over the weekend for the first weekend. I it was way beyond my expectations. So you hit something that the audience, and I think, I don't know, Chekhov just seems right now. I know, just because it's 150th birthday, but it's they're all Russian or Soviet Chekhov films too. So it's their interpretation of this great a writer, but they're first and foremost films, you know, and they understand the film different than the medium they're adapting from. But sometimes you're surprised. I think I like to think that the audiences are ready for something with a little more meat to it. I mean, especially coming off Christmas where you... I was telling Jason these the other day when we were having dinner, these enormous grosses in these commercial films this holiday season. But they're, you know, 99% of them are just pure sugar. And I just think sometimes the people are crashing from the sugar rush, then they just want something a little meat.
Right.
Most of those are comic books.
Yeah. Go ahead, Bob Gaylor.
Yeah. Well, a lot of them that have these big grosses are basically comic books that are animated, you know, essentially.
Yeah. I was just going to praise Brent for his programming savvy, because I wouldn't have touched that Chekhov series of the 10-foot pole. I mean, I would have loved to see the films, but, I mean, that's like...
Well, most of my colleagues, even the ones playing it, they're only playing, like, in five cities, but were the same way. It's like, you know. I don't know. I just had... It's something personally I wanted to do and have wanted to do for a while, so that has a little bit... Was this the right time with the economy like this? Because it's not cheap to get these series.
No, I mean, it's more power to you. I mean, yeah. This is, you know, this is why the CCA has been great, because people have taken... chances, like, you know, like you you set the bar for that, and it's impressive. And, you know, again, with looking through that this binder of programs, I can't get over how adventurous the program has been over the course of 25
years. When I'm out there next week, I'd actually like to go through those again we have lunch or something, because I remember the booklet out there, and it's just been years since I've looked at it.
Well, we've got just a few seconds left. I want to thank you all for being with us. Jason Silverman, director of the CCA Cinematheque, Bob Gaylor, founder and former director of the CCA, Brent Cleaver, director of The Screen, which is the marvelous theater on the campus of the College of Santa Fe, former director of the CCA Cinematheque and curator. Jason, you've got the last word.
Well, I just wanted to say that we had this near-death experience with the CCA the last couple of weeks, and we woke up and said, you know, let's celebrate what we've done. And so we are... we're having a fundraiser this weekend with our new film, the Tom Ford film, A Single Man. So that's 6 o'clock on Friday, and we'll be running that film full schedule for the next 3 weeks. And it's Tom Ford's a local, so it's a perfect way to relaunch.
What's the film about?
It's a day in the life of a gay man who is mourning the death of his partner.
Christopher Isherwood. No.
Christopher Isherwood novella from. When was it, Brent? Do you know the year?
Not off the top of my head.
But a gorgeous film, period piece set
in
1963. A really gorgeous, gorgeous film.
Yeah, get out and support CCA. I mean, that's we've all had our ups and downs there. It seems like the place has 12 lives, so it's meant to be, so to speak, I think. And good luck to Jason. And, you know,
absolutely, yeah.
And we'll see all of you around town. Jason, Bob, and Brent, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
All right. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz presents selections from the top 15 jazz CDs of the decade, including a visit from one of the artists, plus a visit from Lauren Camp.